On this episode of The Big Number, the Cavs collapse in epic fashion at the Garden in Game 1 against the Knicks. We'll talk that. Also, Wemby is off to a historic start in the Western Conference Finals. And Jason Kidd out in Dallas. We'll discuss all this and more coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. I'm Tom Haberstroh. We do this every Wednesday here at Yahoo Sports YouTube channel. Go subscribe, smash that subscribe button, Yahoo NBA. The conference finals are here, probably the best game ones collectively we've ever seen. And we're going to break it all down here at The Big Number with your man, our man, my man, Dan Devine. Dan, how are you?
I am fried, dog. I am not going to lie to you. Double overtime in the West and then going and being on site for overtime in the East with the particular like nerve receptor frying of a 22-point fourth quarter comeback. Literally almost 1 year to the day that the Pacers did the same thing to the Knicks being on the other end of it. Thankfully, I hadn't started the experience of going through it with the Pacers meant that I didn't start writing yet when things started going there for the Knicks. So I didn't have to delete a whole column, but I did have to figure something out by 1:30 in the morning. So we're coming to you live and direct here from Brooklyn, New York, and feeling pretty wild about it. Let's talk about it, Tom. What, pray tell, is this week's big number?
Speaking of things you've got to figure out, the Cavs have some figuring out to do with this week's big number. This week's big number is 13. That's the number of points that James Harden allowed in game one via the isolation play. Got roasted and toasted by Jalen Brunson in game one down the stretch. Gave up 13 points on 11 ISOs. 13 is tied for the most that he's given up in his playoff career on ISOs. We're talking the Houston, Brooklyn, OKC, the Clippers. Any point in his career, he's never give up more points on ISOs than he did in game one with Jalen Brunson just eviscerating him in those one-on-one matchups. 11 ISOs is also the most that he has had defended in any game in his playoff career. You look at this list here, they're all from the same series, Dan, when you're looking at this at home. You're listening, it's that Golden State Warriors 2018 against Kevin Durant Western Conference Finals where James Harden was getting ISO'd, but it was more about Kevin Durant and Steph Curry. Like, that is the way they like to operate sometimes down the stretch. Steve Kerr doesn't usually like to go on that one-on-one matchup, but in that series, James Harden gave up 42 ISOs in that series for 47 points. That, my friends, is a 1.12 points per play rate. In this one, it was way higher. 11 points on 11 ISOs. And most of that was on like five straight possessions, Dan. I don't know what to say other than, was Kenny Atkinson like secretly trying to get James Harden to deny this player option for next season? Was he trying to get him embarrassed and make sure that the front office made sure they didn't sign an extension? Dan, like, I'm watching this game and I don't understand why they just left him out on an island like they did. And Kenny Atkinson famously did not use any of the timeouts to figure things out. At home, could not believe that this was happening, but you were there. I mean, the place must have been bonkers. What was your reaction to watching him every time down the floor in the fourth quarter, just Jalen Brunson target him and eviscerate him in that one-on-one matchup?
Yeah, let's start with Kenny Atkinson has forgotten more about basketball tactics than I'll ever know, right? Let's just start there.
Yeah.
However, watching the fourth quarter, I'm thinking, all right, if the game plan is to give up a soft switch on every wing pick and roll, like every Mikal Bridges, every OG Anunoby, every Landry Shamet, whatever, every pick and roll, give up a soft switch to get James Harden on the ball against Jalen Brunson, what could possibly be the rationale for that? And the best I could come up with was, we don't want to give up threes. Let's make them take tough twos. And it's hard for Jalen Brunson to, you know, shiver and pivot and feint and shoulder check his way into a 11-foot floater against a stronger defender, right? And if he's doing that, all of the other Knicks are out of rhythm. That in theory, right? And you talk about why does Steve Kerr not want to play like that, right? Like, why have the Warriors not just been like step high pick and roll every time? It's because of that, right? The ball finds energy. We want to have more flow in our offense. We want everybody else to be involved. If it's four guys watching Jalen, then, you know, that's not a healthy thing for our offense. And Mike Brown actually said that after the game. Like, we don't really want to, you know, you've got to do what the game dictates is the quote. They were trying to do the same thing with Jalen. We said, okay, we feel like we can play that game. We try not to play that game much, but we feel like we have a guy that we can play that game with in Jalen. And you see why, right? So, like, I'm watching that and I'm thinking, this is maybe at best, it's if you're going to come back on us, you're going to do it 1 2-point bucket at a time. However, they kept getting them. And they kept getting them without much resistance. With Brunson, like, yes, those are theoretically tough shots, like a foot inside the free throw line floater. It's not an easy shot. It's also a shot that Jalen Brunson makes a lot and has made a lot in the playoffs over a lot of different defenders against a lot of different schemes. So it's not like the same level of, you know, 0.8 points per possession kind of shot. Like, with him, it feels like you got to adjust the sliders a little bit on your expectations for what that's going to produce. And so my first thought is, this doesn't seem like it's a reasonable way to defend Jalen Brunson in the fourth quarter of a playoff game. And then when I'm thinking, who's defending him? Okay, it's James Harden on every possession. It's Dean Wade getting switched off. Are they going to try to change the matchups here? Only after, I believe it was 8 straight possessions where the Knicks got either a Brunson basket, a dump off for a Karl Anthony Towns basket, Landry Shamet 3. They take a timeout. It's an 18-1 run at that point. And the tactical switch is Sam Merrill is going to be on the ball now. And we're going to, like, soft shade a double, not even a hard double, really, to get the ball out of Brunson's hands. But, like, we're going to show 2 on him with OG Anunoby 1 pass away. So it's an easy, like, kick bounce pass from Brunson for OG to get downhill, which led to fouls, which led to swings, which led to really, like, the Knicks never stopped getting what they wanted out of this action. And at no point in that process did Kenny Atkinson say, let me go get, you know, not saying that Max Strus is like the Brunson stopper, or like Dennis Schroeder is the Brunson stopper, or Keon Ellis, favorite of blog boys everywhere, is the Brunson stopper. But, like, at no point did they say, let's juggle this matchup. And it was kind of baffling, frankly, to watch in real time, because, like, this is the sort of matchup that in theory you should be making the Knicks work overtime to get, like, really, really work hard to get that preferred bear your soft underbelly matchup. And the Cavs were just giving it to him on every possession. And that's how Brunson and the Knicks walked them down. Like, it was pretty wild to watch in the moment. And rewatching it this morning, it got no less wild, Tom.
Let's hear, Dan, what Kenny Atkinson had to say after the game when a reporter, you know, was like, hey, did you, like, consider moving him out of the lineup and trying to sub someone in for a defensive possession? Kenny Atkinson said this.
He's been one of our best defenders in these playoffs. I trust him. You know, smart, great hands. Didn't think about that.
So, you know, like, Rudy Gobert makes a lot of money. And, like, I'm trying to think of, like, the politics of this. Is that Kenny Atkinson, right? He just beat J.B. Bickerstaff and the Detroit Pistons. J.B. Bickerstaff got a contract extension just before that series for beating Orlando. And, you know, people in the Pistons are really upset, and some, because this always happens when a team gets eliminated early, a number one seed, they're calling for his job. Kenny Atkinson, depending on how things go, he may or may not be campaigning for his job here, in depending on the outcome of this series. He's in the Eastern Conference Finals. Who knows? But for him, can he keep that locker room, or keep James Harden locked if he moves him out of the lineup, if he takes him out of the game in these stretches, like Rudy Gobert does offensively, like other players who make $40+ million, it's a tough power play to take James Harden, who you traded for at the deadline, Darius Garland, swapped Darius Garland for James Harden. And who's to say that Darius Garland wouldn't be in the same position if they were in the Eastern Conference Finals and Jalen Brunson was ISOing him? I don't envy Kenny Atkinson in this position, because clearly James Harden was acquired for this very reason, to perform in the postseason in the biggest moments. However, not using a timeout, not even thinking or considering of subbing him out, in which the Knicks had scored 16 baskets. Or sorry, let me reverse here. They shot 16 times with James Harden guarding him in the fourth quarter and overtime. The next highest guy, Dan, in terms of defending Knicks baskets or Knicks basket attempts, is 4. Evan Mobley defended 4 Knicks shots. Then you have Wade with 2, Allen with 2, Donovan Mitchell with 2, Max Strus with 2. Look at the targeting here. They were going at James Harden for 16 field goal attempts in the fourth quarter and overtime, which was more than everybody else combined. So we're talking a serious strategy here from Mike Brown, who said after the game, we clearly were targeting James Harden, and there wasn't much resistance. There wasn't there was one play where I believe it was Mikal Bridges in the right corner, where they got James Harden off the ball, not ISO'd on Jalen Brunson, and he went towards the right corner a little bit, and James Harden, another poor defensive play where he kind of did a half double, not a full double, off the short corner, and Jalen Brunson made the easy pass for the three-pointer in the right corner, and it was just, it was an abominable defensive performance from James Harden. Very little resistance. And maybe he said, look, I got him. I'm going to get him every step of the way. Don't worry, coach, I got him. And Kenny Atkinson was just trusting the guy who's making $39 million this year and has a player option for $42 million next year. Maybe they're pot committed here. But you're talking about an all-time collapse and one of the great Jalen Brunson performances we've ever seen. And it just seemed like it was preventable. I don't know what you felt like in the aftermath, talking or the reporters there or to asking players in the press conferences. Did the Cavs take the messaging from Kenny Atkinson that they got lucky, like that the Knicks got lucky with a lot of those shots, that they're willing to give up those shots time and time again? And it just, in a make or miss league, Jalen Brunson and Mikal Bridges on that three-pointer at the top of the key where he steps back and hits it. Kenny Atkinson said, we'll live with that. They got lucky. They hit a bunch of tough shots. I was really proud of our group tonight. Did it seem like the Cavs felt the same way? It's like, yeah, I mean, it was just one game and Jalen Brunson kind of on a heater, whatever.
I think, you know, there was a, especially from Donovan Mitchell and Evan Mobley in their podium trip, it was a lot of like, we'll look at the film. And, you know, we'll see what we could have done. And like, that is generally the answer of like, I don't really want to say what I'm thinking right now.
Yes.
I am just going to say, I got to take a look at it. See if I liked the looks that we got, if I liked the looks we gave up. You know, Donovan Mitchell did say, you know, like the message that was delivered in the locker room for him to the team as the leader was like, we effing blew it. Like, but it's only one game, you know, whether you lose by 3 or by 40, you know, like it's one loss. And it's, you know, where we, I do wonder if the we effing blew it quote card is going to do the same sort of numbers as Jared Allen's. The lights were a little brighter than I expected against the Knicks from a couple of years ago. Like, it feels like a pretty memeable situation. But there was the glass half full take was, we spent 3.5 quarters basically doing what we wanted to do. We were able to generate pretty much whatever looks we wanted. For the, you know, especially in the second and third quarters, really getting consistently good looks against that Knicks defense, like finding ways to manipulate their help. We're over getting them to overload to the ball here. Mike Brown spent a lot of the game putting two, in the same way that the Cavs were like ineffectually sending two players to Jalen Brunson, and then saying like, all right, get the ball, either like not really get the ball out of his hands or get it to OG Anunoby with a wide open lane to cut down or one pass away swing to Landry Shamet. The Knicks were doing a lot of that on to James Harden, like putting two on him and then saying, basically daring James Harden to hit the short roll man and then either get a drive to the rim for Jared Allen or Evan Mobley or swing it to the weak side where Max Strus or Sam Merrill or Dean Wade could take a wide open three against a late contest. Like, they were getting great stuff out of that. Their defensive alignment was really strong for most of the game where we didn't see a lot of the cross matching, some of it, but not a ton in the Atlanta series and in the Philly series where you had a wing on Karl-Anthony Towns and a center on Josh Hart. A little bit of that, you know, Dyson Daniels did it a little bit in round one, Paul George a little bit in round two, but mostly they played Cat kind of straight up with their bigs, which opened up the like point Cat that we talked about and him operating as a hub from the top of the key. All the playmaking that came out of that. The Cavs were aggressively from the jump, like, nope, Jared Allen on Josh Hart, Evan Mobley or another wing on Cat. And it really messed with the Knicks offense to the point where, and this is like the, kind of the secret part of why Jalen Brunson was able to go nuts in the fourth quarter. Who's not on the floor for most of that fourth quarter, for the entirety of that run? It's Josh Hart.
Yep.
He left the game, I believe, like 9:52 left in the fourth quarter. And about a minute after that, Brown puts Shamet in. And now it's a five-out spacing. Now, you know, Jared Allen can't just park in the paint on, and sagging off of Josh Hart and daring the Knicks to funnel the ball to him and live with the results. Now it's shooters everywhere. You got to stay home. So if Brunson gets the one-on-one, there's no help. You know, the best you can do, as you mentioned, is that like kind of in no man's land gap help, mm-hmm. where if you're one pass away from Mikal Bridges or one pass away from OG Anunoby or from Karl-Anthony Towns or from Mikal, you know, like these guys are live in those alignments. So the number here, the offensive rating for the Knicks in game one with Josh Hart on the floor was 68.8. And the small offensive number. Rating for the Knicks with Shamet on the floor in that fourth quarter was 168. Like, it completely number. Flipped. That's a much bigger number. 100-point gap in offensive efficiency, pretty big number. And so, like, as you say, they got to figure out some ways to adjust here. That Mike Brown, that it took Mike Brown that long to say we got to get Hart off the floor is one thing. That it didn't take him three games to do it, like it did for Tom Thibodeau in the Eastern mm-hmm. Conference Finals last year, is an improvement in process, right? And you saw yeah. the downstream effects of it in the results. This feels like it could be, for the Knicks' purposes, a big like Landry Shamet series, a big Deuce McBride series. How, I mean, maybe even more double big if you can get the center onto Mitch and then a wing onto Cat. Like, how do you find ways to get more spacing, more five out spacing? The Knicks got there eventually, and the Cavs had absolutely no answer for it.
They've got to figure out, the Cavs, what they're going to do about Harden. Like, they refused to take him out of the game. And there was an amazing play. So it was 7:04 left in the fourth quarter. Jalen Brunson had ISO'd James Harden, and James Harden blocked him. And that was an interesting play, because after that, Jalen was like, all right, I'm going to keep going to this. That was one play, but I'm going to be able to keep going to this. I feel like I got a good opportunity, and he got the block on me. But what happened after that block is that Max Strus fell asleep, and Jalen Brunson, even though he got blocked, the loose ball kicked out to Landry Shamet for a made three.
Yes.
And that was it for Max Strus. Shortly after that, Kenny Atkinson yanked him from the game and basically decided, we're not going to play Max Strus anymore. He fell asleep defensively, gave up that three, and then everything fell apart for the Knicks. I mean, for the Cavs. So I think you're going to see more Max Strus in game two. I think they're going to have to figure out how to switch or stop switching, the soft switch here, where they're just letting Jalen Brunson go at Jimmy Harden in that one-on-one ISO and figure out a way to get the ball out of his hands. We're going to see some of these adjustments. But offensively, too, is James Harden had another crash-out game. We did this 2 weeks mm-hmm. ago, talking about James Harden's propensity to have more turnovers than made baskets. And since that episode 2 weeks ago, he's had another one and another one and another one. So 32 now. The big number a couple weeks ago was 29 games in which in his playoff career that he had more turnovers than field goals. In this game against the Knicks, he had 6 turnovers and 5 buckets. 6 times in this postseason, Dad, that James Harden has had more turnovers than made baskets, and the Cavs are 0-6 in those games. In the games in which he doesn't have a crash out, they are 8-1. Look at that! The Cavs! Imagine when they don't have an all-time crash out from James Harden, they're a pretty good team. So forget about the defense for a second. Offensively, if he doesn't have it going and he's coughing up the ball, and that's not even counting the air ball that he had down the stretch in this one, and he was getting to the line, but in terms of just being able to get buckets with reasonable affectation, where you're able to understand going down the stretch, hey, we're going to get some stability here from James Harden. He was not able to do that on both ends of the floor. And that's how you get a top five largest comeback in the play-by-play era, according to Inpredictable.com, which tracks the comeback scenarios of, like, what was your lowest point in the game? When was the darkest hour of your game? What was the percentage chance of you winning that game? The odds were 1 in 1,665 that with 7 and change to go in the fourth quarter, down 22, 93-71, they had a 1 in 1,665 chance of pulling off the upset, and they did. They rallied from, I think it's a 0.02% chance of getting back in that game. That is the fifth largest comeback in the play-by-play era dating back to 1996. And you see it there, Dad, calling it out. Indiana coming back against the Knicks last year. So there's been a few of those comebacks here. This was an all-timer, and you got to be there for 2 of these. I don't know. Were you there for any of these other ones? But the fact that you've been back in the arena for 2 of these games makes me feel like, Dan, you should never write anything on deadline. Just wait till after the game.
Yeah, tell the editors that. The funny thing about this, so I was not at any of the other 3 in this list, but our guy Ben Rohrbach, he was reaching out to me after the game as I was writing. He was like, so the last one that I can find that's like this, like this bigger kind of comeback late in the postseason game, was that Clippers-Grizzlies game where the Clippers came all the way back in Memphis. And he was like, guess who wrote the blog post about it for Yahoo Sports? I was like, I think I remember doing that one. Yeah, I feel like I was up late on that one. So yeah, maybe
you
it is
did
me.
That
I,
at one this too? Point,
at this point, 60% of these were Dan Devine bylines. So, you know, yeah, maybe there is something to be said here about that. To your point, and there's plenty more to do. There's a whole other series to get to, let alone other news. But as quick notes on the offense, to your point, Kenny Atkinson asked after the game, all the chatter about the defense, and why not take a timeout and yada, yada, yada. He kept going back at the offense, saying, like, I felt like we got stagnant. And sometimes this can happen with fatigue. You know, we stopped moving. We weren't getting as active. One component of that, if you are asking 37-year-old James Harden to be that, like, I'm the engine on everything, the entire fourth quarter and overtime on one day of rest after playing every other day for a month, you know, yeah, things can get gummed up. And a thing to watch moving forward, because I don't know the specifics of it, we'll see if it's anything. It certainly seemed like Donovan Mitchell had like a hitch in his giddy up going down the stretch and into overtime. I didn't see exactly when it happened. I think he came down kind of a little bit funny after a drive late in the fourth quarter. Over the final 13 or so minutes of the game, like from that when the Knicks run started around 7:52 in the fourth, 0-for-5 from the floor, scoreless the whole rest of the way, only 5 field goal attempts that rest of the way. And when asked after the game about, you know, the offense kind of going away from him in that situation, very long pause, like notably long pause for Donovan Mitchell. He kind of sat and thought about it for a minute before he said anything. And then just is like, yeah, you know, gotta go back and watch film. And so at that point, you're like, there's something to this. Yeah, you know, like he really was like, huh, I don't know how I want to talk about what I want to say here. So I didn't say anything. No bulletin board material. But that was what you call in the business a pregnant pause as he thought about what he wanted to say there. I will be very interested to see what that looks like in game 2. Because, yeah, you're talking about it was like a 42 offensive rating over the last 13 minutes of the game for the Cavs. So everything has to go into it. If you the anatomy of a comeback is you stop scoring, you can't stop them. You miss free throws, you turn the ball over, and absolutely all of it happened in game one for the Cavs. And if they do not come back and steal one on Thursday in game two, they will, I think, wind up ruining what happened over those last seven and a half minutes or so of regulation for a long, long time.
I mean, Kenny Atkinson saying after one of the biggest collapses in NBA playoff history, saying, "I'm really proud of our group." It's just, I don't know if Cavs fans feel great about that.
No, really proud of our group. No, I think not.
He's essentially saying, look, the process was fine. The results were not. And you play that game 100 times. We might win that game 60 times. But this was one of those horrible outcomes. And look, the process is also questionable when you're insistent on letting James Harden stay on an island against one of the greatest ISO scorers in the NBA, if not the best ISO scorer in the NBA, Jalen Brunson. It looked like light work for him. He was looking back, like when he got past James Harden, he's looking back casually. All right, I'm going to just take a floater here because Jared Allen's not really, really defending me, coming out and showing hard on this. It just felt like light work, and it wasn't light work for James Harden. I think you're right to hit on this, is that he's turning 37 here. Deep playoff run for a 37-year-old James Harden who's getting targeted defensively and is not able to rest at all on either end of the floor. I think he's going to be running into game two here pretty tired. And that's going to be the theme here for this next segment. We're going to talk about the San Antonio Spurs against the Oklahoma City Thunder, two of the youngest teams in the NBA who went into double overtime. I can't wait to see what happens in game two on Wednesday night. But man, James Harden giving up 13 points on ISOs and all of those coming in the fourth quarter and overtime just feels very ominous. That I don't think Cavs fans feel very proud of what happened after game one. And we'll see what happens in game two against the Knicks at Madison Square Garden on Thursday. Dan, we're going to talk Wemby, 41 points, 24 rebounds in game one, an all-time performance and one of the all-time great playoff games. Coming up right after the break. All right, 13 is this week's big number. That is the number of points. It seems low. It is an all-time career high for him. But 13 points given up on ISOs, all those go into Jalen Brunson. Incredible game one performance from Jalen Brunson. Incredible game. The playoffs have been outstanding, and the conference finals. It's the first time that we've had both games go into overtime, game one conference finals history. So this has been an epic start to the conference finals, Dan. So let's move over here to San Antonio, OKC, the matchup that we've all been waiting for. It delivered and over-delivered in game one. Let's get into it. What is this week's little number?
First of our three little numbers this week, we're going to stay with 13. 13.6 is the first little number. That was the excitement score for game one of Spurs Thunder, according to our pal Mike Bowie at inpredictable.com. His number's there. Has a metric called excitement score that makes measures how far a win probability ticker, you know, that like up and down line of who's most likely to win, how far that travels over the course of a game. A 13.6 excitement score makes game one of the Western Conference Finals the most exciting playoff game in 5 years based on these numbers. And that felt right in the moment. Excitement score, sort of think about like the win probability line as a string. Like if you're pinching it at both ends and pulling it tight, how long is that string? Like, oh my goodness, it's going and going and going and going. That's what excitement score measures. And this was, again, the most exciting game in the last 5 years of postseason basketball. Since 2020, the only games that are up in the neighborhood, there was a Raptors-Celtics second round series in the bubble, game six, and that went into double OT. And then game one of Bucks Heat in 2021, which had 16 ties, 17 lead changes, a Jimmy Butler buzzer beater at the end of regulation, and a Chris Middleton buzzer beater at the end of overtime. So pretty rarefied air in terms of how wild the back and forth swings are. And for this to be in game one of the conference finals between what we have understood as the two best teams in the NBA, this kind of cardiac arrest action is pretty special and rare and pretty interesting in terms of what it might mean going forward. You mentioned this on the other side of the break. Like, now you, Victor Wembanyama is coming off a career high 49 minutes played in game one in this double overtime game. It's not just that, though. It's that every Spurs starter played at least 44 minutes. Devin Vassell played 50. And you know, Mitch Johnson decided to really curtail his rotation, which with De'Aaron Fox's availability being up in the air with the ankle sprain, like Mitch Johnson said, he has no idea if he's going to play in game two. That's worth keeping an eye on. Yes, young legs, but also a heavy workload in that high-stress game. The Thunder, meanwhile, Dagnall played 10 guys like he always does. Only Chet was over 40 minutes. It just wondering if, do you think that all that hectic, the back and forth, the wildness, the heavy minutes for San Antonio, the potentially fresher legs for Oklahoma City, do you think that leads to like a little bit of air out of the balloon bounce back in game two? Or are we about to see another like caffeinated heart attack pounding game two excitement score too?
Yeah, I just can't believe we got this matchup. And secondly, it exceeded all expectations. It's like LeBron coming out and the chosen one on the Sports Illustrated cover as a junior, and then somehow meets those expectations and just obliterates them, right? Like the idea that not only did we get these OKC and San Antonio, but it was an all-time great game. One of those that you just are, all of the tanking, all of the weird shenanigans of the regular season, the headlines for indictments and gambling and all this stuff that happened in the regular season, for us, it felt like, as NBA fans, it felt like, I don't know, like the light at the end of the tunnel of like, this is why we care. This is why we love this league, right? Is because game one and how much they cared. Like Victor Wembanyama going all out for loose balls. And then on that critical play where the out of bounds happened, where he's like, it was off a Chet Holmgren. He wasn't flopping. He wasn't like writhing on the ground. He was trying to get the possession. And it just seemed like so many times the defense was on another level. The effort, the passing, the shot making, it all comes back to me as like this new theory that it's about youth over mileage. Like we talked about James Harden earlier, is that in these postseasons lately, it seems like the young legs, the fresher legs, are outpacing the older guys, the mileage, the high mileage guys. And in this game, Victor Wembanyama did not look like the guy who was in his first playoff season. Did not look like that at all. He looked like the greatest player we've ever seen. Victor Wembanyama, that's how good he was. Like 41, 24, 3-3, and he played a career high 49 minutes. And I don't think he said he was tired after the game, but the way that he was kind of stoically towering over his own bench there at the end of the game, he wasn't hands on knees. It felt like he had a lot more to give and a lot more to say. And Dylan Harper, 20 years old, the youngest starting lineup ever in conference finals history, they're going to be leading on those young legs again in game two. And we just saw the Oklahoma City Thunder win the championship with the second youngest team of all time to win the Larry O'Brien Trophy. These legs are going to be tired, certainly going into game two, but this is not a case of two old heads going at it like Steph Curry and going against LeBron James in the NBA Finals. This is two teams. Look at these ages. Dylan Harper, Carter Bryant, 20 years old. Stephon Castle, 21. Wemby, 22. Champagne, 24, Vassell, 25, the old sage on the team, De'Aaron Fox, is 28, and they might just bought him another game. That they stole game one on the home court of OKC, which means, hey, De'Aaron Fox, if you need to get another game here, we might be able to sustain another game without you. If they lose game one, maybe that's not the case in a double overtime. They might need De'Aaron Fox if it's a 50-50 coin flip. But now, Dan, I think it's a lot easier for them to say, look, we stole game one. If we split game, these two games going back to San Antonio, not too worried about it. So Mitch Johnson, I feel like, doesn't have to pull those sliders all the way to the red zone, the redlining that you might expect if they lost game one, which is why it's so important they won game one.
Absolutely. And with the De'Aaron Fox of it all, like, a little bit easier to make that call too when Dylan Harper, you know, whatever, 2 months removed from turning 20, puts up 24 points, 11 rebounds, 6 assists, and 7 steals in that surprise spot start. Like, yeah, no, it takes some time, man. maybe De'Aaron Fox is like, actually, I'm good. I want to come back as soon as possible. That spot in the starting lineup, I would love to go back and grab that because I don't want to spend too much time sitting over here watching that dude do that. Dylan Harper has been, we talked about him last week on the show, like absolutely nails in his first postseason. And you saw that in game one. Second little number this week, 102.7. That is the Thunder's offensive rating over the course of this season when Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Victor Wembanyama share the floor, according to PBP stats. So that's going back to the NBA Cup matchups, the regular season matchups, and now through game one, 102.7 when you have SGA and Wemby both on the floor. When SGA is on the floor and Wemby isn't, a 124.1 offensive rating. So just for purposes of comparison, 102.7 would be the worst offense in the NBA. 124.1 would be the best offense in the NBA. And while we're talking about small samples here, not a ton of games, not a ton of minutes on one side or the other, that feels pretty directionally accurate that the difference between OKC looking like the best team in the world and not is Victor Wembanyama being on the floor in the middle of the paint defensively. There's some three-point shooting luck at play here. Like the Thunder are down under 30% from three in those SGA Wemby minutes. But like OKC's offense is predicated on SGA driving to the lane to create. And yes, he goes and can make good passes out of kickouts there, but mostly it's like to create for himself, either getting all the way to the rim or getting there and like stopping short for those sort of pull-up mid-rangers, the same sorts of shots that we saw Jalen Brunson hitting in game one. And with Wembanyama there, it's like, he's the Minotaur in the middle of the maze, like drawing you toward him. And if you get there, you're like, oh, wow, wait, I got to deal with this monster. What do I do now? I think there's an interesting trend to look at in terms of SGA's passing on these drives. Overall regular seasons from Second Spectrum's tracking data. Overall for the regular season, SGA passed out on 37.9% of his drives, passed out to a teammate. In the playoffs, 41.7%. Against the Spurs in the regular season, 50% pass out rate. Against the Spurs in game one, 53.3% pass out rate. So he's getting into the lane and he's kicking it out on more than half of his shot, his drive attempts with Ahmed there in the game. And that, again, feels right, right? You know, you think about all those possessions and it's just how loaded up. They're showing SGA a wall on like every possession and saying, all right, Alex Caruso, go make 9 threes. Jalen Williams, we'll deal with it. Chet Holmgren, yeah, we'll see. We believe we can rotate out to you and we're going to take our chances. We'll see who, all of these other guys, the secondary creator, yeah. AJ Mitchell, sure, try to make something happen. We'll see if we can deal with it with our positional length. So all of which is to say, Tom, it makes me wonder, like, is this just really a case of the Spurs have the guy to neutralize this offense? Or are the Thunder maybe, can they find some answers if they see a steady enough diet to this?
This is the crazy part, Dan. They got a game in which Alex Caruso had 31 points and 8 threes, and they still could not score efficiently with Wemby on the floor. They had an all-time, like, Klay Thompson, you name it, Ray Allen, three-point shooting, Western Conference Finals, 8 of 14 from downtown, and it still didn't really put in a dent in the Wemby experience. And that's the scary part, is they got a 100th percentile performance, outlier performance, from the guy who, Isaiah Hartenstein couldn't play. They just did not want to be. He started off on Wemby, and then it just didn't go very well. And Mark Daigneault did not trust him, only 12 minutes in this game, and preferred going small with Alex Caruso guarding Victor Wembanyama. They got problems, man. Like if you're having an all time great performance from Alex Caruso, role player turned into a superstar, and still was not getting efficient offense, needing the entire 48 minutes to just cross over into 101 points for them in regulation, that screams problems that this is actually going to be worse in game two with facing Wemby. That the process here, you were getting an outlier. Kenny Atkinson, I would wonder what he would say about Alex Caruso's shots that he was hitting in this game. He would probably say, yeah, we'll take that every single time. And yet, I think the real problem here for the Thunder is that Victor Wembanyama is killing Chet Holmgren at every opportunity. And it's so fun to watch. Just these two guys, that they've had such a serious history together. And whenever he gets lined up with Chet Holmgren, he just he roasts them like barbecue chicken in this game. So like I looked this up. Chet Holmgren has not been in the regular season the number one defender for Victor Wembanyama, but this is something that OKC has to solve, because if you're going to beat him offensively, you got to figure out a way to get Chet Holmgren going, or Chet Holmgren getting a shot in the first 20 minutes of the game. But in this matchup, this historically, Chet Holmgren is has not been the primary defender on Wemby. That would be J-Dub, had 55 possessions in the regular season. He had 30. He had a bunch of possessions in this game lined up against him. Alex Caruso got a bunch of possessions. Caruso, when guarding Victor Wembanyama in game one, Wembanyama shot at a rate of 14 shots every 100 possessions. So 14 shots every 100 possessions when guarded by Caruso. J-Dub, 30 shots every 100 possessions. Oof. So going at J-Dub a little bit more, looking for his shot. Lu Dort had the third most possessions guarding Wemby, according to NBA.com player tracking info. Lu Dort, 16 shots every 100 possessions. That's the scoring rate, or the attempt rate, when going against Lu Dort. Jalen Williams, the other Jalen Williams, 25 shots every 100 possessions. So between Caruso, Lu Dort, J-Dub, Jalen Williams, it was anywhere between 13 and 30 shots every 100 possessions. I say all that to say this. When Chet Holmgren was guarding Victor Wembanyama, he was shooting 90 shots every 100 possessions. When Chet Holmgren was guarding
him. He does not like that man. He does not like that young man.
90 shots. He every chance he got, he was going right through Chet, right at Chet. And so if you're Mark Daigneault and you can't trust Isaiah Hartenstein, and you can't really trust Chet, and he had a great block there at the end of the regulation there, but this is barbecue chicken time for Victor Wembanyama going against Chet Holmgren. And that's the problem here, is that the guy, the 7-foot-1 dude, unicorn that you drafted and is an all-NBA player, can't do anything against Victor Wembanyama. And that dunk right there, Kendrick Perkins saying after the game, here's the quote, "Victor Wembanyama doesn't like you. You need to have the same feelings for him." So if they're going to have to figure out, yes, they have to figure out defensively, how are they going to attack Wemby defensively and have that offensive rating be higher than 102 in game one, or in the entire season. But part of that is we got to get more from Chet offensively, and trying to figure out a way that we can have Chet at the five and guarding Victor Wembanyama and have more offense. Because we got an all-time great performance from Alex Caruso, and it did not matter.
Which leads me to the third and final little number this week, is 18.8, which was Victor Wembanyama's offensive rebounding rate in game one, according to Cleaning the Glass. The raw stat was 9 offensive rebounds, a career high for Victor Wembanyama. That is as many as the Oklahoma City Thunder had as a team in game one of the Western Conference Finals. He got 3 on one possession very early in the game. Just kind of like bulldozed through Chet to clean up a transition 3 and then play volleyball on the rim. Here we go. Just like over, tap, tap, tap. But many of them, it was, as you mentioned, they're guarding him with these wings, right? It's Jalen Williams. It's Alex Caruso. It's Lu Dort. It's Cason Wallace. So it's, you know, SGA on a switch. And Victor Wembanyama is able to just go over the top and grab it, you know, and either putting it back or resetting for a teammate. And so like, the rate stat here, again, 18.8% offensive rebounding rate. That is tied for Wemby's second highest rate of the season, which was against the Oklahoma City Thunder on December 23rd. And that's interesting because it's 2 of his top 3 offensive rebounding rate games against the Thunder, 3 of his top 9 offensive rebounding rates against the Thunder, 4 of his top 16 against the Thunder, and 5 of his top 22 against the Thunder. Mm-hmm. And this, again, tracks with, they want to guard him with smalls and then have Chet or Hartenstein, but largely Chet, kind of roaming behind. And on like, there's on one level, you know, we talked about it in that, the game one roundtable that we wrote, where you and I both wrote with Steve Jones and Ben Rohrbach at Yahoo Sports. You can go check that out on the website. Like, this is the defensive tactic issue question that I think Mark Daigneault's got to figure out. Like, on one hand, you can't give up 9 offensive rebounds a game to the biggest guy on the floor, right? Like, if you keep guarding him with smalls, that's going to keep happening. On the other hand, You're up three with 40 seconds to go in overtime. They were scoring. The offensive rating for the Spurs in Wemby's minutes was like still like I think it was like 109.3 in game one in Wemby's floor time. That would be a 29th ranked offensive rating in the regular season. Yeah. Like, again, process versus results. Do you look at that if you're Mark Daigneau and say, we got to switch it up. We got to be able to play him straight up with Chet, even if he's going to try to shoot 9 times out of 10 with Chet on him? Or do you say, our process was sound enough? We lost this game on offense, not on defense, even though Wemby went for 41. Like, I don't know how you answer that question. I'm wondering if Mark Daigneau knows how you answer that question.
Yeah. He had more rebounds, Victor Wembanyama, than the entire starting lineup for OKC. He had 24 rebounds and OKC starting lineup hit 23. And it's just the size. I mean, it's kind of obvious. The dude's 7'18", right? He's so tall. Right. But that is such a matchup nightmare for this team because clearly they don't trust Chet to guard him and Hartenstein they don't trust. And they prefer Alex Caruso or J-Dub or Lou Dort in this matchup just to have that kind of it's harder to guard Victor Wembanyama out on the perimeter. He operates like a guard, you know, a lot of times driving and being able to have that strength, that low center of gravity has been, in Mark Daigneau's eyes, effective. They did the same thing against Nikola Jokic in the Western Conference Finals last year. And you're going to see a lot more Caruso, maybe even starting game two. But they've got this problem that you're pointing out is they're getting killed on the boards. And it's going to be up to Chet and up to Hartenstein or collectively to try to keep them off the boards. I mean, this is why I picked the Spurs to win it all. Is I think Wemby is the greatest player on earth. I think he's been that way for the last few weeks. At the end of the regular season, as he was making his late charge and saying, I think I'm the most valuable player. And the concussion kind of changes things, but it doesn't change the fact that he's able to dunk the ball without jumping and he's got guard skills and he's able to, oh, we don't have De'Aaron Fox. I'm going to run the offense for this team. He's just, Dan, like, I don't know, man. I don't know what buttons they push. I mean, it was double overtime; could have gone either way. But extremely encouraging start for the San Antonio Spurs to steal that game one without De'Aaron Fox. And we'll see what happens. But with Wemby on the floor, they just have no answers. And that was the case in the regular season. That was the case in the NBA Cup. It's just the Spurs and the way that they have these young legs. They can match the speed and the deflections and the intensity and the discipline of OKC. It's like a mirror. It's Spider-Man meme, except Chet Holmgren is 5 inches shorter than the other guy. And usually Chet Holmgren's bigger, stronger, better, faster than the other opposing center. And in this matchup, it's checkmate. And so we'll see what happens in game two. Dan, we've got much more to get into here around the league. Some new staffing news out of Dallas is that Masai Ujiri taking over for the Dallas Mavericks, hiring Mike Schmitz, and getting rid of Jason Kidd, said, hey, your services are no longer needed here, and we're going to move on without you. We're going to talk about that interesting move there by the Dallas Mavericks coming up after the break. All right, Dan. So playoffs, incredible, but there's also some drama off the floor. We got the Dallas Mavericks. Masai Ujiri takes over as the president of basketball operations, also the alternate governor for the Dallas Mavericks, which means suggests that he might have a little stake in the ownership group, taking over that job for Nico Harrison. And now he is going to go forward without Jason Kidd, who had reportedly been angling for a president of basketball operations gig himself. And Patrick Dumont, the infamous, much criticized owner there, managing partner of the Dallas Mavericks, deciding, you know what, Jason Kidd, we're going to hire Masai Ujiri. And according to ESPN reporting, he was not looped in on the Masai Ujiri hire. So maybe the writing was on the wall. To begin with, that Jason Kidd was kind of getting a feeling According to ESPN's Shams Charania, the Mavs also let go of several members of the basketball operations department on Tuesday, including assistant general manager Matt McCarty. Sources said McCarty served as an interim general manager along with Michael Finley, but Finley's future is undetermined at this point, according to Shams Charania. And he said, yeah, Kidd expressed a desire to be promoted to president of basketball operations after Nico Harrison was fired in November. Palace intrigue here for sure. When you look at the Dallas Mavericks with this young team, they traded away Anthony Davis. They're resetting, apparently, it seems, around Cooper Flagg. Kyrie Irving coming back from the ACL tear, did not play this season, but certainly Masai Ujiri is operating from a clean slate, hiring Mike Schmitz from the Portland Trailblazers, former assistant GM there, and is now the GM with the Dallas Mavericks, clearly moving into a rebuild or set, because Mike Schmitz is one of the best draft minds of in the NBA, coming from ESPN and Draft Express, being hired directly to the front office of the Blazers, and now running the general manager duties for this team that last year had Klay Thompson, Anthony Davis, and Kyrie Irving, and now we'll see what happens going forward. But Masai Ujiri saying at his press conference, as we evaluate the future of our basketball program, we believe this is the right moment for a new direction for our team. We wanted to get rid of him. Now, one thing I'll note, Dan, I don't know where Tim McMahon possibly had gotten this information from, maybe Jason Kidd himself, but when this news dropped, there was a quick report right after it saying, Jason Kidd has 4 years and $40 million coming to him still on his contract. So he's going to be okay. And there are offsets. Shams Charania reporting here that well over $40 million left.
Yeah.
Ed Dumont and the organization's like, yep, we're good. There are sometimes offsets. So what that means is if you get hired, if Jason Kidd goes out and gets hired for another job here, the way it works is sometimes the previous team is off the hook for the remainder of that previous contract, and the other team just picks it up. But it depends on the language of the contract. If he has 4 years and $40 million plus left on the contract, he could feasibly just be like, I'm going to Cancun, I'm good, and I will see you guys in 4 years. But we know Jason Kidd is not wired that way. All of these guys are... Doc Rivers was at ESPN and left mid-season. And told the ownership group, I don't want that job. Why are you giving me this offer? And then a year and change later, he's out too. So I suspect he will be back in the NBA in some form or fashion. I don't think it's going to be a president of basketball operations, but this is an interesting job for the next head coach. I assume they're going to go younger here and build around Cooper Flagg in the same way that the San Antonio Spurs and Oklahoma City Thunder said, hey, Mark Daigneault, and we're going to go Mitch Johnson. It seems like, to me, you had Billy Donovan and Greg Popovich, and they went young, and they built around this young core with a young head coach, Joe Mazzulla, over there in Boston, too, with the same sort of pattern. I wouldn't be surprised if Masai Ujiri and Mike Schmitz did the same thing here in Dallas, replacing Jason Kidd.
Yeah, looking for their own version of like the Brad Stevens out of Butler kind of situation, right? Like, you know, we want somebody with like the long runway to be able to sort of figure this out. I will be honest, like this broke while I was like getting dinner before Knicks Cavs game one. So I had kind of like, I'm playing catch up a little bit on it, and a bunch of different thoughts kind of ran through my head. First of which was, we are a little less than a year removed from the Knicks wanting to hire Jason Kidd. Remember, there was like in the aftermath of the Tom Thibodeau firing, it was like, can we get the opportunity to interview all these sitting head coaches? And one of them was Jason Kidd. And one of those things, like several of those coaches got extensions off of that. Like, we're not going to let you interview, so we're going to pay you more. So yeah, I don't know if maybe Jason Kidd owes Leon Rose like a gift basket, an edible arrangements or something for bumping up to that $40 million that he's got coming to him. But, you know, obviously what a difference a year makes, you know, Kidd on the way out and the Knicks, you know, back in the conference finals with Mike Brown, they're like the eighth choice in that process being the head coach. The other thing that I thought of was Nico Harrison's line from after the Luka trade. The quote was, in the future, 10 years from now, They'll probably bury me and Jason Kidd by then, or we'll bury ourselves. And that's, you know, February 2025. And like a year and a half later, they gone, both of them, they're out. And it's, you know, to the point of like Masai Ujiri saying like clean slate, you can certainly understand why, like, you know, whether Jason Kidd, as you know, a very credible head coach, got the Mavs to the NBA finals, has had success in multiple places over the course of his career, right? But like, there was no turning things over without fully turning things over. Like, you have to completely like replant all of the crops after the Luka trade, right? And so this removes that lingering odor to whatever degree you can, right? Like, and say new chief basketball executive, new GM, there will be a new head coach, and we are, you know, we've moved on from Anthony Davis, Kyrie, TBD, we'll see what happens there. And we are moving forward fully. And then I think the third thought that I had from this was like, I guess, relatively speaking, how attractive is this job now, right? Because like after the Luka trade, I think you would have said like, why in the world would you want to coach this team? But now you've got Cooper Flagg, you've got the number 9 pick in this draft. Yes, you are out picks moving forward, but this, with Masai Ujiri in place, with an ownership that is going to both pay and, it sounds like, get out of the way to give Masai Ujiri that opportunity to run. Like, what do you, does this profile as a pretty attractive opportunity to you?
It, for sure. It's Cooper Flagg. Cooper Flagg and a blank slate. You know, that's it. And for a Dallas Mavericks organization that is also going to get a top pick in this draft, you know, so they're going to have 9th in this draft. They have Cooper Flagg. I suspect a team like Detroit will call about Kyrie Irving just to get another shot creator there next to Cade Cunningham. I don't think that Kyrie is going to come back for the Dallas Mavericks. I think they'll probably hit the reset button on that aspect too, and Klay Thompson. Whether the Avengers or what other superhero thing you want to talk about with the Golden State Warriors, with LeBron, Klay Thompson, Kawhi Leonard next to Steph Curry, I don't know, but I would suspect that Klay Thompson probably is not going to be in Dallas again next year. Because look, I think when you hire Masai Ujiri and Mike Schmitz and you have a new head coach, it seems like a full-on reset. And for a team that has Cooper Flagg, who's, you know, barely 19 years old, I think it makes sense for you to just build for the future, not for right now. And so there's still some deals for Dallas to have to figure this out, what they look like going forward, restoring a lot of their draft picks and trying to get out from these contracts where for this team, you still have PJ Washington, you still have Klay Thompson, Daniel Gafford. This is an organization that is in a full out reset. And for next year, they've got $39 million going to Kyrie Irving. They got $17.5 million going to Klay Thompson. 3 more years left on Daniel Gafford, 4 more years with PJ Washington, 2 more years with Caleb Martin. Dan, I think all of those players could be moved by the time that that next season starts and they're going to do a full reset here. And I think that'd be very appealing to a young head coach. Is like, hey, we've got a long runway here. Jordy Fernandez over there in Brooklyn, it reminds me of that. Or Charles Lee in Charlotte is like, we're going with the youth movement and we're going to give you a full-on runway here. Don't worry about the results in year one. All that matters is that we're going to build a sustainable rebuild around Cooper Flagg. And I think that's going to be very appealing for a lot of young head coaches around the league.
Just, you know, wondering as we start our trade machines going, like, is there a way to get Kyrie up to Minnesota, maybe? Like, you know, I don't know. Hey, remember Julius Randle's from the Dallas area, right? You know, maybe there's a Julius, a returning, or, you know, rehabilitating Dante DiVincenzo pack, you know, something. Maybe there's something there. I don't know. We know that there needs to be some, you know, some ball handling and some shot creation next to Anthony Edwards and a point guard to take some off his plate. I don't know. You are right to point out, this opens the door to some other conversations. But I think the general take here is like, the Dallas Mavericks, the last year and a half has been, how do we turn the page after this like traumatic, chaotic rupture of trust with our fan base? And now the orchestrator of the trade is out. The head coach who was the face of all of it happening is out. You have a new face of the franchise, and the player that you received in exchange for Luka Doncic is out. This is like breath of fresh air. We see what we, you know, take a step back to take a step forward and see where we go from here. And I think you're right. Like, if you're talking about the young talents to build around, hard to come up with too many that are more exciting than Cooper Flagg, given what he put on film over the course of his rookie season, especially after that rocky start where, you know, playing point out of position, all that kind of stuff. You start building a team where you spread the floor around him. You continue to feed him opportunities to drive and create. You know, the future can look pretty bright there pretty fast. And yeah, I think the idea of you bring Mike Schmitz in to find the winners with the limited draft capital you've got, right? Like, it's, you know, you might not be picking at the top of the draft every year because of the picks that are out the door. So you got to nail the ones that you do have. And, you know, the job starts now for that mm-hmm. Dallas Mavericks front office. And Jason Kidd, yeah, like, if I was me and someone said, we're going to pay you more than $40 million to go away for 4 years, Tom, you would need a new co-host, my brother. I love you. I love doing the show, but you would need somebody else sitting in this chair until the next, you know, a couple of elections from now. But we'll see if Jason Kidd is still wired more competitively than he wants to get back in the game. But for me, I'd think long and hard about this being a good firing for me as an employee.
Yeah, well, Dan, I don't think he's going to be hired by Henry Abbott at TrueHoop.com, my former boss over there at TrueHoop. Henry tweeting out, I covered Jason Kidd when he played for the Nets. I know one of his childhood friends. I've been to his house, met his kids, then wife, and Pilates instructor, and I have insight from many people who worked with him in his coaching years. This is a great firing. So Henry has thoughts about Jason Kidd, and so do the Dallas Mavericks. Decided, yeah, he went to the NBA Finals a couple years ago, but we've decided to part ways. You know, it's tough because a lot of the coaching vacancies have already been filled here for Jason Kidd, so he might be taking the year off. He might latch on with someone as an assistant coach like he was over in LA before he had this job with the Dallas Mavericks. But man, the NBA comes at you fast in this league. Luka Doncic out in Dallas. So is Nico Harrison. So is Mark Cuban. So is Jason Kidd. So just a couple years after going to the NBA Finals, a completely different organization than the one that took on the Boston Celtics there a few years ago. So as the world turns in the NBA, I'm sure as we finish this up today, there's going to be more that we'll talk about next week on The Big Number. Thanks so much. I want to thank everybody behind the scenes. That's Emmy and Brad Pauly behind the scenes. Thank you so much for building out this show and making this dream of a show a reality. Thanks so much. And also subscribe. Reminder, Yahoo NBA at YouTube, our new YouTube channel. Go check that out for the Dunker Spot and KOC show. I'll be on the Kevin O'Connor Show tomorrow live at 11:30 to discuss game 2 OKC and San Antonio and all the other happenings in the league. Dan, thank you so much. Get some rest and we'll catch you after game 2 and the rest of the series here.